WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Country music has become the mainstream American music. As Bruce Feiler writes in his new book, Dreaming Out Loud, country music was once the voice of working-class Southerners, but it's become the voice of the new American majority, middle-class suburbanites. In the 90s, country became the dominant radio format in the U.S., and by 1993, 42% of the radio audience was listening to country radio every week. Feiler's book examines how Nashville and country music have changed by focusing on the careers of two stars, Garth Brooks and Wynonna Judd, and one newcomer, Wade Hayes. Feiler has written about American music for the New York Times, The New Yorker, and The New Republic. He now lives in Nashville and New York. He says he grew up hating country music and Nashville. I asked him what Nashville represented to him.
Well, I grew up in Savannah, Georgia. I'm actually a fifth-generation Georgian, but I hated the symbolism of it. I hated the hay bales and the hound dogs and the overalls, and it sort of was a set of shackles that bound me to an outdated image of the South that I couldn't wait to escape.
And what does Nashville represent to you now?
That's an interesting question. To me, Nashville now is actually sort of the best combination of sort of old Southern imagery with a sort of modern edge to it. So it's sort of neon and apple pie. It's dirty fingernails and designer clothes, if that combination works. I think what happened to me was I left the South after high school. I lived in the Northeast. I lived abroad for 5 years, and I found that though I had tried to escape that imagery of the South that I didn't like, I still felt attached to certain aspects of it that I think as a child I'd overlooked, that being, say, storytelling, or that being a sort of a sense of bedrock, a sense of narrative, a sense of place that I found that when I was living in a remote corner of Japan or traveling in Europe, that's what grounded me to home. I still felt pulled back. And when I came back in the 90s and started hearing contemporary country music, it spoke to me as a person who grew up not liking that imagery, watching Saturday Night Live and wanting to be in New York, say. But the sense of values is what grounded me and pulled me back, I think. And I think that's what pulled people to Nashville. People who didn't like country music also, that's what's pulled them to Nashville in recent years.
Your book describes a little bit how Nashville became the capital of country music. Can you give us a little crash course on that? Why Nashville?
Well, that's a really good question, because in the 1920s and 30s, when these Opry-like radio programs that played traditional Southern music were coming into being, they were broadcast from lots of places, Shreveport, Louisiana, Dallas, Atlanta, Chicago. And essentially, these were programs that were ways for large companies to reach rural listeners. The Opry is broadcast on WSM, which was owned by the insurance company. WSM stood for We Shield Millions. So at that time, it could have gone anywhere. Nashville became the headquarters for several reasons. One, it's centrally located. 30 states are within 600 miles of Nashville. And 600 miles being significant because that's precisely how long a bus would take to go overnight and play there. So what happened was the Opry was the publicity machine. On the weekends, the stars would play the Opry. People would hear about them. They'd get in their vans or their buses. They'd go out to the places during the week and play concerts in high school gyms, then return back to Nashville. So it was central. The musicians started living there because they could get these gigs also. And then in time, the publishing. And when the song publishing came to Nashville in the 1950s, basically because Fred Rose's wife was from Nashville and he felt homesick, and Fred Rose came back, they formed Acre Rose Publishing. So once the publishing was there, the money stayed, the musicians were there, the studios came, it came to Nashville essentially in the 1950s.
Well, a lot of your book focuses on Garth Brooks, and you see him as the kind of father of new Nashville, or of new, how would you put it, new country music?
Yeah, I think new country, hot country, young country, but I think contemporary country works for me.
Is there a lyric of Garth Brooks that you would choose that you think kind of exemplifies his appeal to baby boomer country listeners?
I think the classic Garth Brooks song, as far as I'm concerned, is Unanswered Prayers. And what happens in this song, it's Garth and his wife go back to his small town, and they run into the woman who he had adored as a child, and he's looking at her, and he's remembering that every night he would pray to God to make her mind. And at just the moment of the song when it risks becoming a cliche, and you think he's going to leave his wife for the girl, he looks at his wife and he says, you know, first of all, he looks at the woman and he says, you know, she's not quite as wonderful as I remember. And then he looks at his wife and he says, you know, I really do love my wife. And he says some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers. What's amazing about this is it sort of perfectly anticipated the family values ideas of the 90s, right? I mean, go home to your wife. It's a sort of fanfare for the reconciled. And though he was sort of a young man at the time, he was in his early 30s, he really spoke to those baby boomers who were saying, you know, it may not be exactly what I wanted, but hey, it ain't bad what I got.
Well, let's hear it. Garth Brooks, Unanswered Prayers.
Just the other night, at a hometown football game, my wife and I ran into my old high school flame. And as I introduced them, the past came back to me, and I couldn't help but think of the way things used to be. She was the one that I'd wanted for all times, and each night I'd spend praying that God would make her mine. And if He'd only grant me this wish I wished back then, I'd never ask for anything again. Sometimes I thank God for unanswered prayers. Remember when you're talking to the man upstairs, that just because he doesn't answer doesn't mean he don't care. 'Cause some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers.
That's Garth Brooks, and my guest is Bruce Feiler, and Bruce Feiler's new book is called Dreaming Out Loud: Garth Brooks, Wynonna Judd, Wade Hayes, and the Changing Face of Nashville. Now, Garth Brooks, you say, got his success in part by creating albums, designing concerts, and devising a persona that all reinforced a single image. What was the image?
The image was Garth Brooks as the modern-day cowboy. What Garth did, and this is actually something that I don't think Garth has spoken a lot about, is he set himself out to become a modern-day John Wayne. More than sex, more than money, more than power, all of which, granted, he had more than his share of, he wanted to turn himself into this icon. I see him as this little kid in rural Oklahoma looking up at those heroes on the screen and wanting to become one of them. So in all aspects of his life, at least in the beginning when it was really working, from what he wore Wranglers, which because cowboys wear Wranglers. He wore these old-fashioned Western shirts. He wore the hat. And the hat had been around for lots of years, but it had sort of become gaudy in recent years after the urban cowboy boom of the 80s. He wore a very simple hat. It was yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. But what he did was update it for the 90s. When I think a classic Garth story is that early in his career, like so many young artists, he got carried away and he started sleeping around on his wife, came back to his wife. His wife heard about it. And he and his wife went on national television in 1991. He confessed to his infidelity. He apologized and they promised to rebuild their relationship. It was the cowboy for the age of Oprah who would confess his transgressions and promise to do better. And I think it's worth noting here that it was a year later to the day, almost, that Bill Clinton went on 60 Minutes and followed that pattern to a T.
What pressures did it put on Garth Brooks to have succeeded in becoming an icon? How could you see that take shape when you were spending a lot of time with him writing this book?
Well, I think that's precisely the key change that did happen in Garth's life. I mean, when you create this figure that is this sort of idealized cowboy who is aw shucks, gee whiz, just so glad to be here. The problem is that a really great responsibility to live up to. As Garth's career went on, he tried to live up to his early success, which was in the early half of the 1990s, 10 million, 11 million, 13 million copies sold of each of his first three albums. And what happened was is eventually Garth began doing a lot of stunts to make sure he could get back to that number. I think what happened to Garth is something along the lines of what happened to Madonna. If you think back to the 1980s, every 6 months Madonna would change her image. She would have some media events to create spectacle around her. In the beginning, that was very fresh. It was exciting. Wow, this is a woman who is experimental. But after a while, the public began to see that she was changing her image every 6 months, and they sort of turned on her. And that's sort of what happened to Garth. He really made numbers really important. The sales figures were really, really central to his identity and to his success. It said to him that the public was really responding. When those numbers began to dip in mid-decade, he became increasingly desperate to get those numbers up, and eventually the pressure sort of really overwhelmed him. I met him around the time that Fresh Horses came out in 1995, and he talked about the voices in his head. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do if it doesn't work? He talked about laying in a fetal position on his farm for 3 days, worrying that the public was not going to like it. And that pressure, I think, the moment I think that it changed, came to bear at the American Music Awards in 1996 when he was given an award as Best Overall Artist in all genres of music. It was the first time the award had been given. And Garth felt, well, my album sales have been disappointing, and I haven't performed publicly in a year. And he decided to leave the trophy on the podium at the stage. And it was widely viewed as a media stunt. And though in Garth's mind it was, well, my sales aren't up, so therefore I don't deserve it. It was the straw that broke the back of the camel and that sort of started this momentum of, oh, my God, Garth is really, he's going to lose it.
How do you think all this pressure to keep up with the numbers affected his music?
I think what happened was, in the beginning, you're an artist. You come from Oklahoma. Garth was born in Tulsa and grew up in Yukon, Oklahoma, which is a bedroom community outside of Oklahoma City. You really have this passion to express what is in your heart. Those early songs like Unanswered Prayers, If Tomorrow Comes, which is about a man looking at his daughter sleeping in the night and wondering, will she know that he loved her if he dies in the night? They're small. They're simple narratives. They're great big messages. As his career went along, the messages started getting bigger and grander. I'm an icon. I get to speak to the entire world. The change, you know, the world is going to give pressure on me, but I refuse to change. He kept reaching for the stars with every song. And I think that if you listen to The Change, it really exemplifies. You can feel the pressure on his shoulders.
My guest is Bruce Feiler, author of Dreaming Out Loud, Garth Brooks, Wynonna Judd, Wade Hayes, and The Changing Face of Nashville. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Bruce Feiler is my guest. He's the author of the new book Dreaming Out Loud, Garth Brooks, Wynonna Judd, Wade Hayes, and The Changing Face of Nashville. One of the performers profiled in your new book is Wade Hayes, and you watched him as he was in the process of becoming a country music star. And one of the things you focus on in his story is about how his records are researched before they're released. What is the process of researching a record, basically seeing are consumers going to like it and buy it? Will they prefer this track or that track? What was the research process like for his records?
First of all, a little background. Radio is the backbone of country music. There are essentially 10,000 radio stations in America. 2,500 of them are country radio stations. Country, though it has only about a sixth of the record-buying market, has a third of the listening audience. Pretty much 30 to 35% of people listening to radio at any given time are listening to a country radio station. It has become the mainstream radio format in the last 10 years. That means there is an enormous amount of money at stake. When you're spending $150,000 to $250,000 recording a record, the radio labels, they need a hit. When people are buying consolidated radio stations at four or five times their multiples, they are having to make sure that people stay there. The result is this research, market research process, which I think is basically sucking the soul out of country music. And it works something like this. Wade Hayes releases a record on a good night. It's the title cut off of his second album. Sony Records releases that to 180 stations that report to the charts, Billboard and R&R. And they need to move it up those charts, and the rest of the 2,300 stations will then play whatever the reporting stations are playing. After about 4 or 5 weeks, when consumers have become accustomed to hearing the song, they employ this market research. They employ these companies. They call 100 people at dinner time between 6 and 9 p.m. They play these 100 people 6 seconds of 100 different songs. That's On a Good Night or I've Got Friends in Low Places. And they ask these consumers to rate the song on a scale of 1 to 5. 1 if they like it a lot, 5 if they don't like it a lot. They tabulate all of these numbers, and they rank the songs according to popularity, and they fax them around to all the radio stations, and the radio stations basically program the songs that people like a lot. The reason is because the programmers have to report to station owners who have to report to these conglomerates. They are scared. There's no more individuality. The day when Loretta Lynn, like in her movie, A Coal Miner's Daughter, could go to a station, sweet-talk the DJ, play him a record, he could have it on the air in the afternoon, those days are dead and they will never come back. But the problem with the research is that the research has consistently shown that songs that test really well, songs that get ones, also get fives because they excite a lot of passion. Some people like them a lot. Some people dislike them a lot. Leanne Rimes' Blue is a classic example of this. It had a yodel in it. People don't like yodels. Really high scores, really low scores. What radio stations are interested in is not good music. Radio stations are interested in having people stay around for 5 more minutes and not change the channel so they can listen to a commercial. So what happens is the radio stations end up favoring the songs that are in the middle, the 2s and 3s and 4s. So the research, though it sort of promotes safety, also promotes mediocrity.
And you say in the book that most of the songs that get both the very high and the very low numbers, the real positive and the real negative responses, are the ballads. And the songs that are get the kind of middle response without a lot of negatives are the up-tempo tunes, so there's a lot more emphasis on up-tempo.
There's a lot more emphasis on up-tempo, the ditty. And some of these songs are great songs. I've Got Friends in Low Places, for example, is a great song. The problem that the labels face in Nashville is ballads move product. The songs that people feel passionate enough to go buy the records are the real emotional songs. But these songs are not getting on the radio. And I think what it's basically showing here is the tension. The radio stations have one objective, the record labels have another objective, and the artists have another objective. Now, if you're Wade Hayes, if you're a 26-year-old kid and you're fresh from one of the smallest towns in Oklahoma, you are really beholden to what your record label wants you to do. And what was going on with Wade was Wade constantly trying to do the right thing. The days of Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson saying, up yours to the record label, I'm going to grow a beard and do drugs and have a good time, those days are long gone. You've now got the era of the yes ma'am, no ma'am artist. And unfortunately, the yes ma'am, no ma'am artist is not always necessarily an artist. He's looking at the bottom line like everybody else. And so there it is, that the commerciality just sort of hovering in the air in every decision. And as you know, you just can't make artistic decisions if that is so preeminent in your mind at every given moment.
Well, why don't you choose one of Wade Hayes' records that you think illustrate why he became so popular?
I think the best Wade Hayes record that captures that sense of him as a young, sexy person, but also as a traditional person, is his first song, Old Enough to Know Better. And if you listen here, you can feel the tradition in his voice, that he tries to sound like his hero, Waylon Jennings. But you can also hear a sort of youthful bravado that's just coming out. And it's, if you compare it to Unanswered Prayers, where you have sort of a young 30-year-old man speaking to people who were his elders, a sort of patron saint of the baby boomers. In Wade Hayes, who was essentially the same age when he did Old Enough to Know Better, you can hear someone speaking to people who are his junior, and you can see country music sort of changing its focus from looking toward older people to looking toward people in their young 20s and even in their teenagers.
Okay, well, this is Wade Hayes.
like a moth to flame. Mama raised me right, that just leaves me to blame. But when I get a little sideways on honky tonk tear, I'm old enough to know better, but I'm still too young to care. Cowgirls with an attitude, boots and tight blue jeans, take my mind off doing right and doing other things. When the weekend's gone, I won't have a dime to spare. I'm old enough to know better, but I'm still too young to care. Monday morning I wake up with a hammer in my hand, the boss man yelling something at me that I don't understand. I don't know how I got to work, but I sure know I'm there. I'm old enough to know better, but I'm still too young to care.
Bruce Feiler is the author of Dreaming Out Loud. We'll talk more about the changing face of Nashville in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bruce Feiler, author of a new book about country music called Dreaming Out Loud, Garth Brooks, Wynonna Judd, Wade Hayes, and the changing face of Nashville. One of the little episodes that you cover is the story behind an album cover for one of Wade Hayes' CDs, and there's a lot of controversy about which photograph to use for the album cover. Give us a sense of what the controversy was about. What was the choice of pictures?
Wade Hayes is a handsome man. He's 27 years old. He's tall. He's lanky. He's got the good looks. The issue here is to wear the hat or not to wear the hat. When Garth had his success in the early 1990s, the hat became the symbol of all things Nashville. And what happened was the record label started cramming hats onto all these citified young artists. Oh, you graduated from Vanderbilt? Doesn't matter. Put a hat on you. You never set foot on a farm? Doesn't matter. Put a hat on you. And the hat sort of became a token of the homogenization of country music. So Wade Hayes happens to be from Oklahoma. The hat is a very natural part of his upbringing. However, the marketing people wanted him to take the hat off because they wanted to show that he was young and sexy. They knew that television bookers, Jay Leno and David Letterman, are not putting artists on who have hats because they seem to be anonymous. So Wade wants to wear a hat. For him, it's sort of almost like a safety blanket and a sort of statement of who he is. And the label wanted to take it off. And there was this moment in the course of this afternoon when we were shooting these photographs, and it was a freezing cold winter day, and we were in this dude ranch in this cabin, and a fire was burning, and they took a couple of shots with the hat on. And Bill Johnson, who is the photo director, he used to work for Rolling Stone, he walks up and he was sort of mentoring Wade, and who's being very avuncular, and he sort of talked to him and created this atmosphere of security, and he said, let's take the hat off. And so they took the hat off, and a sort of really an electricity filled the room, and they took these wonderful photos that really showed the character of this man. And Bill later took those photographs and overlapped them with a picture of a hat, trying to get both looks in there. But Wade's camp said, no, Wade is Bear Aspirin. He's a brand. People won't know who he is. And the battle waged back and forth, and everyone got very emotional. And in the end, the producer decided, okay, let's put the hat back on. They put the hat back on, and I have to say, as much as I love Wade, they chose an album cover that really didn't do the music any justice.
It's amazing that the hat should be so so important and yet so controversial. You know, that the emblem of the hat should be such a big deal because it's such a cliche. It's amazing that it even has any potency anymore. It's become such a cliche.
Well, it's become such a cliche. At the same time, what you have here is you've got this basic tension that goes on in American life between the culture that comes from New York City and Los Angeles, which is the culture of irony, which is the culture of cynicism, which is the culture of sex and youth and rebellion. And Nashville is trying to stake a claim for itself as the music of earnestness, as the music of values, as the music of Americana. And for better or for worse, the hat has become emblematic of that.
Politicians who want to draw crowds and align themselves with popular groups often call on country groups to perform at, benefits and fundraisers and political events. How does the country music world divide now between Democrat and Republican?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, traditionally, it has been perceived to be a bastion of Republicanism. It was definitely viewed as being against, very much aligned with the Republican Party. Again, though, in recent years, as it's become younger, as it's become more suburban, as it's become more interested in a sort of new set of problems, there's this whole Democratic streak that's now taking over Nashville. And the other thing that's going on is that the Democratic Party has moved more in the direction of country music. So I think there's a sort of benign centrism that really gets expressed in country music now. I mean, think back to Garth Brooks singing We Shall Be Free. Garth Brooks' sister is a homosexual, and he included a line in the song, "You should be free to love anyone you choose," which he said openly meant homosexual love. There were some people that got into an uproar about that, but basically the country audience accepted that.
Of course, we have a Southern president, too.
Well, we have a Southern president. I mean, the similarities between Garth Brooks and Bill Clinton, I think, are enormous and fascinating. They're both basically men of the New South, or actually that region where the South, Midwest, and Southwest collide. They both come from fractured families with strong mothers. They both have larger than life appetites, whether it be power or women or food. They both have this eating problem. And it's interesting, as the decade has progressed and these two men have been such dominant figures, the problems that they have faced are really precisely the same, which is that they both have this aw-shucks image of being honest and straightforward, yet both are increasingly perceived, as the decade has gone on and as their problems have increased, as having a problem telling the truth. They are both perceived now to be so self-serving to the point of being manipulative. So these two men who made sincerity sexy are now routinely characterized as being insincere. But what they both had that made them successful is they had the ability to appear empathetic to ordinary Americans, both over television and in person. And it's that same skill. "I am you," Garth would say to his fans. "I feel your pain," Bill Clinton would say. I don't think it's a coincidence the two of them have been the dominant figures of this decade.
You describe Garth Brooks as somebody who's really focused on his own success and on the numbers that will empirically illustrate how he is doing. How is he doing now?
It depends on who you ask. I mean, Garth Brooks, his new album Sevens came out in November. It started selling at an enormously fast rate, 600,000 units a week, making it one of the fastest selling albums of the decade. And what happened was Capitol Records, he had a feud with his record label last summer. The album was supposed to have come out around the time that he played Central Park in August of last year, but he did not like the management. He had a feud with the first manager that he served under. That was Jimmy Bowen, and Bowen essentially was forced to leave. And then they brought in a new man, Scott Hendricks. Garth also did not like him, so he went to a feud with the people at EMI, and then Scott Hendricks was asked to leave. Eventually, Garth delivered the record in November. It started selling very quickly. The new head of the label, Pat Quigley, spent an enormous sum, what he has identified as $23 million, to try to get Garth Brooks' record to $10 million, which was the plateau he wanted to reach. But unfortunately, as soon as Christmas was over, the record sales plummeted from 600,000 units a week to somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 to 45,000 units a week. And Garth became upset and sort of desperate in an attempt to get the numbers back up again. He sold 4.5 million copies of this record. By any measure, that is an enormous success. Unfortunately, by the measure of his previous success, it is disappointing. So I think that Garth is feeling the pressure of, again, of trying to live up to his own standards. one of the most, I think one of the best quotes that I have in my book is from Garth's mother. I was with her backstage in Atlanta before Garth's first concert in several years, and we were talking about Garth's attempt to make himself into John Wayne, and she said, "If I could say anything to my son, it would be, son, be happy. You're there. Enjoy it. You have become the person you've set out to become." But unfortunately, Garth, when I asked him about that quote, he said, that's sweet, but she's wrong. I'm not here yet. I'm not there yet. There are 2 billion, there are 5 billion people in the world. I've sold 67 million records. You do the math. There's still a lot of people that I haven't reached. That's the answer to the question.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Bruce Feiler is the author of Dreaming Out Loud, Garth Brooks, Wynonna Judd, Wade Hayes, and The Changing Face of Nashville.